The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am pleased to introduce a writer who has appeared on this stage many times during the last three decades. Solomon Jones is an award-winning Philadelphia News columnist and morning host for 900 AM WURD Radio. He is the author of the Essence best-selling novel, The Bridge, as well as the critically acclaimed books Pipe Dream, Ride or Die, Payback, and The Dead Man's Wife. He is also a blogger and frequent on-air commentator for NPR affiliate WHYY, and is founder of Words on the Street Literacy Program and the Rally for Justice Coalition. Jones previously taught creative writing at Temple University, worked as a columnist for the Philadelphia Weekly, and served on the boards of several committees to end homelessness. In his new book, 10 Lives, 10 Demands, Solomon tells the stories of people whose lives and deaths pushed the Black Lives Matter movement forward. He explains how each act of violence was incited by specific instances of structural racism and offers an actionable guide for social justice advocates to reform racist institutions and policies. Please welcome Solomon Jones.
How's everybody doing? It is a pleasure to be back here at the Free Library of Philadelphia, where I have done events for the last three decades. Man, it's unbelievable. The first time we came here, my wife, Levita, was pregnant with my daughter, Eve, who's now 20 years old. And taller than us with these heels on that she got on tonight. So it is great to look out and see colleagues and friends and my mother and my aunt and so many other people, man, who are just so important to me and so important to the work that I do. I don't know if any of y'all could beat my mother at this point. She's read the whole book. So we love and appreciate her for more reasons than you know. I want to jump right into this book, 10 Lives, 10 Demands, Life and Death Stories in a Black Activist Blueprint for Racial Justice. I never planned to be a guy who wrote about race and racism. That's never who I wanted to be and never what I wanted to do because I didn't want to be pigeonholed. I've been writing professionally since 1993. When I was making $35 an article for the Philadelphia Tribune. And I never wanted to be the guy who just wrote about race because I always felt like I'm bigger than that. I have more to say than that. But sometimes God will put you in a position to do what needs to be done in the moment, to talk about, to write about, to shout about what needs to be done in the moment. And it's interesting how some of these things come about. I started writing about race for the Philadelphia Daily News because they asked me to. My white editor, Sandra Shea, came to me and said, look, we need somebody to write about race. We think that you are the person to do it. You're already talking about it on WURD, and it is a topic that is important right now. We want you to do it. And I said, that's fine, I'll do it. But here are my ground rules. You can't tell me what to write. You can't tell me how to think. You can't tell me what to say or how to say it, because if I'm going to write about race, I need to be honest about it. And that means that sometimes I'm going to talk about what's wrong from a conservative point of view, but sometimes I'm going to talk about what's wrong from a liberal point of view. Sometimes I'm just going to talk about what is going on in our community and how we're affected by what's going on around us. And they said, great, that's what we want. Yeah, okay. But to their credit, they have been true to their word, and I have been able to do that. This book was a labor of love. It was a book that my agent came to me and said, look, you know, it's time to write a book about race. I know you've written these novels. I know you've written these short story collections. I know you've been a part of these other collections. But right now, in this moment, you need to write a book about race. And what I learned in becoming an activist, which is another thing that I didn't want to do. I just keep doing this stuff I don't want to do. What I learned in becoming an activist was that you cannot be an activist if you don't have demands. That you can't win in a movement if you don't have demands. If you don't have demands, you go out in the street, you scream and holler, you tear up some stuff, you make some noise, and then they take down a statue and say, see, we helped you. You need to have demands. You need to know what you want before you ever get to the street, before you ever draw up a sign, before you ever open your mouth. You need to know before you begin to protest what your demands are. Frederick Douglass was right because he said power can seize nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will. He was right then and he's right now. And so what we've seen is a lot of protest, a lot of demonstration, a lot of passion, a lot of emotion, a lot of anger, and people should be angry. We've watched too many of our people die. But the reality is that you can't change anything unless you know what it is that you want. You have to know what your position is. You have to know what your fallback position is. You have to know what your strategy is to get what it is that you are protesting about. And so my life experience has brought me to this moment. And it has brought me to a place where I can now look back and kind of reflect on where I've been in ways that I haven't really done publicly before. And so this book starts out with an 11th story, my own. And so I'll read a little bit from 10 Lives, 10 Demands, starting with the preface. I'm getting old, this writing looks small. With dull and vacant eyes, I stared into the camera. My skin, normally the rich brown color of dark chocolate, was dry and gray. My unkempt hair was dirty and tightly curled. My facial expression was that of a man resigned to the belief that he would die homeless and crack addicted. It was that picture, a mugshot from one of my 7 arrests for charges ranging from retail theft to attempted burglary, that marked my first television appearance. No one was asking my opinion on CNN back then. I was simply a piper, a crackhead, a disposable cog in the wheel of a drug culture that thrived on the desperation of people like me. But on that day, when they flashed my mugshot on Philadelphia's Fox 29, I achieved an infamy normally reserved for murderers. I was one of the city's most wanted, and most viewers who saw my picture likely believed I deserved to be punished. More than 2 decades later, they'd believe the same thing about a black man named George Floyd. The narrative of black criminality came straight from the war on drugs, a political strategy that targeted African Americans as far back as the early 1970s. The demonization of black addicts like myself made for entertaining television. More importantly, it served as the pretext for an all-out attack on black communities. That's the way John Ehrlichman, an advisor to President Richard Nixon, laid it out in a 1994 Harper's Magazine interview when Ehrlichman explained that Nixon's war on drugs had 2 enemies, the anti-war left and black people. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities, Ehrlichman told the reporter. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. That's exactly what happened. On June 17, 1971, President Richard Nixon walked into a White House press briefing and said, America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive. Nixon was using the language of military conflict to describe his plan to fight drugs, and that was no accident. America's losses in Vietnam were producing ever more damaging headlines, including the 1968 murder conviction of Lieutenant William Calley, commander of the American soldiers who brutally slaughtered 22 Vietnamese civilians in what became known as the My Lai Massacre. If Nixon wanted to be reelected in 1972, he desperately needed a war he could win. By announcing that the war on drugs would be coordinated in the White House, he set himself up as the conquering heroes. Hippies and blacks would be the casualties. Nixon not only won re-election with that strategy, he set the stage for the establishment of the Drug Enforcement Agency, and the war on drugs became a mainstay of American politics. Even after Nixon resigned and the Vietnam War ended, thus eliminating the anti-war left, blacks were still targeted with devastating consequences. In 1982, as crack cocaine began to alter America's drug landscape, President Ronald Reagan said, "Drugs are bad and we're going after them and we're going to win the war on drugs." His wife Nancy became the face of the infamous Just Say No campaign. While Reagan and his political allies instituted racist laws, such as the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, under that law, distributing just 5 grams of crack, a low-cost form of cocaine more accessible in black communities, carried a minimum 5-year federal prison sentence. One would have to distribute 500 grams of powder cocaine, an expensive form of the drug used in affluent white communities, in order to get the same 5-year federal sentence. The drug war escalated under President George H.W. Bush, who used the DEA to hire and to lure an 18-year-old black high school student named Keith Jackson to an area near the White House. Once there, Jackson sold drugs to undercover agents and was arrested in a publicity stunt that enabled Bush to brandish a bag of crack during a nationally televised speech. Bush said at the time that solving America's drug problem would require more prisons, more jails, more courts, more prosecutors. Over the course of his presidency, Bush made that approach a reality. He increased the federal drug control budget from $5 billion to over $12 billion and increased the federal prison population by over 16,000 people in just 4 years. Jackson, that 18-year-old who sold the crack that Bush showed on national television, was among the imprisoned. Though federal prosecutors did not win a conviction for the crack sale near the White House, Jackson was eventually sentenced to 10 years for a previous sale to undercover agents. That kind of sentencing became the legacy of the drug war in black communities, where African Americans were already being disproportionately arrested and jailed for marijuana. With the advent of crack, a quick, intense, and cheap high that put men in graves and women on the streets, black communities were in tatters. The family structure disintegrated. Drug dealing was rampant. Property crimes were common. Murder rates skyrocketed. Black leaders asked for more police to stem the tide of drug-related violence and got much more than they bargained for. President Joe Biden, then a fourth-term U.S. senator from Delaware and chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, helped to write the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994. In the run-up to the bill's passage, Biden took to the Senate floor and used language that was rife with racial undertones to win his colleagues' support. "We have predators on our street that society has, in fact, in part because of its neglect, created," Biden said during an impassioned speech. He went on to describe a cadre of young people, tens of thousands of them born out of wedlock, without parents, without supervision, without any structure, without any conscience, developing because they literally have not been socialized. They literally have not had an opportunity. Biden added that he wasn't concerned about why someone is a malefactor in society and that criminals needed to be kept, quote, "away from my mother, your husband, our families." At a time when political survival meant embracing a tough-on-crime stance, Biden and his white colleagues on both sides of the aisle were eager to push this legislation through. They were joined by members of the Congressional Black Caucus like longtime South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn, who supported the legislation despite the racial rhetoric that made the bill palatable for conservatives. Then-President Bill Clinton, long seen as too liberal by those on the political right, enhanced his own crime-fighting bona fides by signing into law that bill. Among other things, the legislation put tens of thousands more police officers on the streets, implemented drug courts, and gave mandatory life sentences to criminals convicted of a violent felony after two prior convictions, the infamous three strikes rule. Despite the tough penalties it contained, the law didn't serve as a deterrent. The potent mix of crack cocaine and poverty drew desperate people to the drug trade and hopeless people to addiction. Instead of providing sorely needed resources, the 1994 law would ultimately accelerate mass incarceration and devastate black communities. For African Americans, that was a familiar outcome. Since 1619, when our ancestors were kidnapped and brought to the Americas in shackles, the dehumanization of blacks has often taken place under the guise of upholding the law. As Ta-Nehisi Coates notes in The Case for Reparations, his seminal work in The Atlantic, American law worked to reduce black people to a class of untouchables and raise all white men to the level of citizens. In 1650, Virginia mandated that all persons except Negroes were to carry arms. In 1664, Maryland mandated that any English woman who married a slave must live as a slave of her husband's master. In 1705, the Virginia Assembly passed a law allowing for the dismemberment of unruly slaves, but forbidding masters from whipping a Christian white servant naked without an order from a justice of the peace. In that same law, the colony mandated that all horses, cattle, and hogs now belonging or that hereafter shall belong to any slave be seized and sold off by the local church the profits used to support the poor of that said parish. So I'll stop there. And I'll continue a little bit later. But the point is that we have to understand that racism in America is baked into the law. That it's been that way from the beginning, that it's still that way now, and that in order for us to deal with that fact, we have to first understand how the law works and then understand how to change the systems that put these laws in place. We have to understand how to challenge these systems. We have to look for precedents. We can't just scream and holler. We can't just say that Black Lives Matter. We have to demand that they do. We have to do. We have to do more than just be angry. We have to be strategic. And I think the other thing we have to do is understand that not everybody is against us. I think we have to understand that sometimes we have to find common interests with people who don't look like us, people who come from outside of our community, people who understand the difference between right and wrong and are willing to do something about it. I think that we have to have a plan. And that's what this book is about. This book is about having a plan. It is about moving in a direction that looks at these heinous cases, looks at these lives that have been lost, looks at these lives that have been altered, and then looks at why these things happen, how these things happen, and how there was no consequence for those who did it. We have to understand that. And I think that, my role in writing this book is to help us to gain some understanding so that these 10 demands can be a point of discussion and can move us in a direction where maybe these aren't the exact demands that we have, but we realize that we gotta have something. I wanna continue. And I'll start on page 13 in the preface. Measuring crack cocaine and its impact, a 2006 study by Harvard's Roland G. Fryer Jr. and researchers from the University of Chicago found that in the decade between 1984 and 1994, the homicide rate for black males aged 14 to 17 more than doubled, and homicide rates for black males aged 18 to 24 increased almost as much. The study also found that in the black community, fetal death rates, low birth weight babies, weapons arrests, and the numbers of children in foster care increased sharply during the crack era. It was against this backdrop that the media began to exploit black misery for America's viewing pleasure. National shows like the CBS News special 48 Hours on Crack Street put a microscope on individuals who'd lost themselves in swirling clouds of smoke. In doing so, the media helped to bring about Nixon's vision of the war on drugs, a vision that helped to bring a vision that John Ehrlichman said would allow blacks and other enemies to be vilified night after night on the evening news. That was where I found myself on the night the local Fox affiliate displayed my mugshot and called me one of Philly's most wanted. I was the one being vilified. I suppose the system needed another black drug addict behind bars, or perhaps the media needed another black story to exploit. Either way, as I stood behind a marble desk, oblivious to the fact that my mugshot was being broadcast on local television, a blonde-haired news anchor ran through my aliases in my list of petty offenses. Then he said my real name, Solomon Jones. With that, the wreckage of my past was laid bare for all to see. The addiction, the crimes, the bench warrants, the truth. All of it confronted me in a single newscast, and the racist strategy that had survived from Nixon to Bill Clinton was on me like a heavy weight. I was now the face of America's racist war on drugs, at least that's how I was portrayed. In truth, I was simply a doorman, a concierge of sort. To the white, well-heeled residents of the condominium complex where I was employed, I was just a young man working his way through Temple University's School of Communications and Theater. However, like most black men who come from impoverished neighborhoods like North Philly, my story was more complicated than that. It was influenced by the ills that were thrust on my community, and my own poor decisions made things worse. Addiction had almost killed me more than once, and in living through that trauma, I'd already beaten the odds. The job was supposed to be the next step in my comeback, and though I'd previously started over after losing everything, this time was going to be different. This change was going to be permanent. But now my mugshot was on television, and since there was no TV at my desk, I didn't even know it. That is, until the phone rang. I picked up and listened with growing dread as a friend explained that he'd seen me on television. They were saying I had bench warrants, that I was one of Philadelphia's most wanted. I remember my throat going dry and my heart racing wildly, but I don't know what I said to him in response. I only recall feeling the intense fear of being trapped as I hung up the phone. Then I dialed the one person I believed could help. "Mom," I said when she answered the phone. "They showed me on the news. They said I have bench warrants. What should I do if somebody asks about it? I can't lose this job." She paused, no doubt recalling all the time she told me to be honest, to tell the truth, to do all I could to be an upstanding man. But in that moment, she was afraid that all I'd done to change my life would be for naught. My mother told me the only thing she could. "Say it wasn't you," she said. "We'll figure out the rest later on." After my mugshot blazed across television screens citywide, I waited for my shift at the front desk to end, half expecting the police to walk through the glass doors and arrest me. When they didn't, I went home knowing what I had to do. I talked to the one person I trusted enough to advise me on what must come next, but even before my mother uttered the words, I knew the answer. "You have to turn yourself in," she said. I did, and my mother went with me. It was an endless walk to the room where my fate would be decided. With each step, I felt a deep sense of foreboding, like everything I'd done on the streets of Philadelphia was waiting for me on the other side of the door. I could feel the beads of sweat popping out on my forehead as my heart beat against my chest. My breathing was shallow and my eyes were unfocused. I couldn't see what was in front of me. All I could see was a past I dragged behind me like a weight. It slowed me down as I walked through the door, but once I made it to the other side, something clicked. And though I would struggle a few times more, I knew that addiction would not destroy me. That was 26 years ago. After each of my cases was dropped, I walked into a future I couldn't have imagined back then. But now, I'm worried about sharing the details of my past. Will the world view me differently when they learn of my arrest record? Will it matter when they hear how far I fell during my struggle with drugs? Will they care that I was never convicted of any crime? I honestly don't know, but I'm sure I have no refuge other than truth. And the truth is, I'm not the only one who suffered during the height of the war on drugs. The entire black community was stripped of everything, even to the point of death. So that's the first story. There's 10 more after that. But each story is followed by a demand. And that is so important, man, because I remember one of the reasons why I understood why demands were so important. There's a couple of reasons. One is that when I led the Rally for Justice Coalition and we went to police headquarters and we protested because police had placed all of this racist stuff on Facebook, and these were the people patrolling in our communities. We met before we even went there, and we decided that we would bring together all of the different organizations that represented our communities. And the reason that we did that is because what will happen when you protest is that they'll pick off one group and say, well, we made a deal with the NAACP. And meanwhile, you know, the National Action Network is over here and Power is over here and another group is over here and Black Lives Matter is over here. And they like, well, you know, y'all, that we made a deal with them. And so we decided that you're not going to do that. We all going to come together. Who you going to make a deal with now? Right. And so we understood that as a strategy. But the other thing that we understood was that when we protested, the protest was about bringing them to the table. It was about demanding that we have a meeting. And then at that meeting, these are the things that we want. Or there will be more protests. There will be some media pressure. There will be embarrassment. There will be national stories. There will be blood. There's going to be some problems, right, if you don't come to the table. And so we were able to do that. We're able to meet with the mayor and the police commissioner. When that police commissioner left, we were able to meet again with the mayor and the interim police commissioner. We called community meetings. We involved the community in everything that we did. And we got over a dozen police officers at one time fired in the city of Philadelphia for engaging in that racism. That had never happened before. Never happened before. But we were able to do it because we had demands. And so when you read this book, and I'll let you read those stories because I think we're going to get ready to do a Q&A. But when you read this book, you'll see that every story is attached to a demand. I started with George Floyd because George Floyd was the latest of these tragedies that had happened. And I started with George Floyd, quite frankly, because George Floyd reminded me of myself. When I saw the way that they said, well, George Floyd was on drugs, right? And so, you know, it's not that this police officer knelt on his neck and had him crying out for his mama because he couldn't breathe. It wasn't that. It was that he was on drugs. No, George Floyd had an arrest record. That's why it happened. It's because George Floyd was a thug and he deserved that. And so it's not because this police officer knelt on his neck for 9.5 minutes. It's because George Floyd is America's most wanted. It's because George Floyd put himself in that position. It's because George Floyd is a drug addict and a criminal who deserved to die at the hands of this police officer. And it's not because of what that police officer did. It's because of what George Floyd did to himself. It reminded me so much of my own story. It reminded me so much of myself. And when George Floyd called out for his mom, see, when I called my mom, she was able to answer, right, and give me that mother wisdom. Say, it wasn't you. You know what I mean? We figure out the rest later on, you know, and I'm going to go with you when you go to turn yourself in. When he called out for his mother, there was nobody there. There was nobody that heard him, right? And so I saw myself in George Floyd, and the first thing that came to mind for me was reparations. And the reason why reparations came to mind is because there is a path to win on reparations. Somebody asked me, I did an interview yesterday, and they said, well, are you talking about reparations for slavery? No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about reparations for the war on drugs. I'm talking about reparations for all of the things and all of the people and all of the money and all of the stuff that was taken out of our community through the war on drugs. See, when you talk about reparations for slavery, that argument has already been made. And the argument is, well, y'all weren't there and you can't prove that these were your ancestors because y'all ain't had no birth certificates. Well, why didn't we? Right? But you can't say that we weren't there for the war on drugs. You can't say we wasn't there when you took Big Mama house because somebody was selling weed down the street and you claim they were selling it out of her house. You can't claim that we weren't there because you took this person out of our community and put them in jail for decades for some marijuana, right? You can't claim that we weren't there for that. And there is a path to winning. There is a precedent for that. And it happened right here in Philadelphia where the district attorney's office took $72 million worth of stuff, worth of cash, worth of houses, worth of cars out of the black community. And they were sued. But the interesting thing was they had been doing this to black people for years. Now, when it happened to somebody white, suddenly it was a national story. They were on TV crying and talking about their son who had sold marijuana, and they didn't know that the son was selling marijuana, and they took our house. Well, suddenly it was a national story. But what happened was there was a class action lawsuit that was filed, and so some of that money was able to be put back into the community. Well, that's a precedent that can be followed in communities around the country in order to bring about reparations for the war on drugs. And once you open the door to reparations by fighting that battle and winning it, well, then you could talk about some of the other stuff that happened before that. These strategies are about winning. These strategies are about having demands that can be accomplished. And they show strategies that have worked in other parts of the countries. One of the things that I said in this book, and I asked them to change it, but it was too late. I said, it was defund the police. I said, y'all need to change that. That's too unpopular. It's like, it's too late now. It's already in there. That's what happens when you write a book quick, right? But when we talk about defunding the police, what we're talking about is taking some of the resources that are used for policing. I think it's about $750 million budget for police in Philadelphia alone. That's too much. Y'all getting too much money, right? And so what needs to happen, in my view, is that you take about a third of that and you put it into social services, you put it into mental health, and you allow these people to answer the calls that the police aren't trained to handle and shouldn't have to handle. Right? Passing the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act is one of the demands. And you pass that act because what it does is it changes the threshold that you have to reach in order to convict a police officer who has violated somebody's rights. Right now, it's they have to be willful in violating somebody's civil rights. They willfully did it. Well, how do you know what somebody willfully did unless you're in their head and can read their mind? I can't read nobody's mind. You can't. None of us can. And so that's an impossible threshold to reach. And it's purposeful. You know, well, you just got to prove that they willfully did it. That's all you got to do. And it's like, come on, man, I can't prove that. Well, he can't be convicted. And so it changes that threshold from willful to knowing or reckless, right? You can prove that somebody was reckless. You can prove that somebody knew what the law was because, you know, it was in your training. It's written down. You signed off on it. You know what you were trained to do and what you were trained not to do. And so you did it knowingly, and we can prove that. We can prove that you were reckless in doing it when you shot into a crowd and killed an 8-year-old girl named Fantability. Right? You know, we can prove that. And so that's what this is about. There should be a brother here tonight named Hassan Bennett. Hassan, you here? That's my man. That's my man right there. That's my man right there. Hassan Bennett is the subject of chapter 3 in this book. Hassan Bennett is a hero, man. They put Hassan in jail. How many years was this, Hassan? Almost 13? Almost 13 years for a murder he didn't commit. Right? And so Hassan had a lawyer representing him. And after a while, Hassan said, you know what? This dude is incompetent. He wrote to the judge, had the lawyer removed. Hassan came and represented himself at trial, at a pretrial, and then at a trial. And he almost won the first trial, right? They got him, it was 11-1 in favor of acquittal. So it was a hung jury. And then he went back and he represented himself again. And when he represented himself, he wore his prison blues. He said, I didn't want to lie to these people about anything. I want y'all to know I'm in jail for this. And Hassan had studied the law so thoroughly that Hassan represented himself and got his conviction overturned. Hassan is a hero. But Hassan has not received compensation for the years that he was in jail for something that he didn't do. And so chapter 3 is about the case for compensation for the wrongfully convicted. Black people, of course, are more likely to be wrongfully convicted, more likely to face longer jail sentences for stuff that they did not do. And so the demand is that those who are wrongfully convicted must be compensated, and police officers and prosecutors who commit perjury, tamper with evidence, or coerce witnesses to obtain wrongful convictions must be fired and criminally charged. That's the demand. Because the police officer who coerced witnesses to lie about Hassan Bennett's case still works for the Philadelphia Police Department. How does that happen? How does that happen? When you've been in the paper time after time after time for doing the same thing over and over and over again, how are you still employed? But it doesn't just happen here in Philadelphia. It happens all over the country. And there are states where there is compensation. And so, again, looking at the precedent, where does this thing happen, right? Where does it happen that people are compensated for the time that they spend in prison for stuff that they did not do? You look at that as a model, and then you replicate it nationwide. When they tell you it can't be done, you say, nope, they're doing it in this state. And they're doing it in this state, and they're doing it in this state. It's about winning. It's about understanding how the system works, understanding where the system works, and then replicating the things that work in other places. So you talk about Breonna Taylor. Breonna Taylor, who was killed in a raid at her house, awakened from her sleep with a boyfriend. They had went out for the night and they had watched a movie. Breonna Taylor never been in trouble in her life. They claim that they had a no-knock warrant. They did have a no-knock warrant, but they say, oh, we knocked. Well, if you had a no-knock warrant, why would you knock? Y'all lying, right? Nobody heard you. And the only person who said they heard you was somebody who said it afterward, right? After everything been on the news and everything like that. But even after they shot into her apartment and killed Breonna Taylor, they were never charged with killing Breonna Taylor. They were charged with endangering the neighbors by shooting recklessly into the apartment window. I remember watching the judge announcing it on TV, like, okay. And she started reading these charges, you know, reckless endangerment of somebody named CT and reckless endangerment of BW and reckless endangerment of RB. And I'm like, well, when you going to say BT? When you going to say Breonna Taylor? She never did. Because they were never charged. And the reason why that, you know, you could say, well, you know, we didn't do what they said that we did is because they did not have on body cameras. And so they could say anything happened, right? They had a no-knock warrant. And they said, well, I know we had a no-knock warrant, but we did knock. Yeah, okay. But you can't prove it because they didn't have on body cameras. And so the demand is that officers who disable body cameras or fail to wear them during deadly encounters must be criminally charged, period. That should be a crime. They must face discipline up to and including firing for disabling cameras during any encounter. Police departments must also be made to share footage of any police activity with the public upon request. You can't hide that footage. That's ours. Where you get the cameras from? How you pay for them? Oh, with tax dollars. Oh, that's our stuff then. That's not your stuff. Give us our stuff. Right? Both the cameras and the footage are taxpayer-funded property and should be treated as such. In addition, the use of no-knock warrants must be banned in every jurisdiction. That's the demand. That's the demand. And so I'm going to stop now, and I'm going to take some questions because I know we got to get out of here. I appreciate you guys coming out and listening to me ramble, talk my mess. Y'all can listen more tomorrow on the radio. I'll scream and holler some more. But I'm going to take some questions. So if you raise your hand, let me know this person and then that person.
You've brought up some very historical points.
Thank you.
In Philadelphia and around the country. You mentioned about the home ownership and people's homes being taken away from them. Are you mentioning Act 135 or any kind of eminent domain that was done in any period, or are you just being generalized? That's the first part. And then we are experiencing a housing shortage because of a number of the issues that you've spoken about.
Yeah.
A lot of our community members are incarcerated and they've lost their homes and their families have had to deal with those losses. So this is all connected. So I just wanted to know how you would tie that all together and if there's any solutions to some of the housing issues that may have been done with governance, city governance, or impact of communities, like the war on drugs was a major impact on loss of property to Black Americans throughout the United States.
Yeah. I did not talk about eminent domain. I wanted to really stick to what was relevant to the story that I was talking about. And so I talked about the war on drugs, and I talked about what's called civil forfeiture. When you can be accused of being involved in drug dealing and they can take your house. You don't have to be found guilty. And that's what happened to a lot of people here in Philadelphia and in other jurisdictions around the country. And so I stuck to that, talked about civil forfeiture and the use of civil forfeiture to take people's houses and then to fund the very entity that took their houses so they could keep on doing it. We're going to take your house, sell the house, take the money, put it in the DA's office, hire some more people to come out and take some more houses, right? And so it is inherently, problematic. It's problematic.
Good evening and congrats on the book.
Thank you.
I do plan on reading all these little tiny words.
Aren't they little? Man, I'm 50-something now. I can't. But go ahead.
My question is, after reading these 10 demands, is there a blueprint to actually demand? Is there a way for Hassan to get retribution or reparations for what was committed against him and the other people? What do we do next?
I'm going to let Hassan speak for himself in terms of what he's doing in order to get recompense for what happened to him, because I think he deserves to have his own voice and speak for himself. But in terms of the plan, the plan is to look at what's happening in other states, and that's what's laid out in the book, to look at what's happening in other states where compensation is paid to people and to then use legislation in order to put that in place in every state, right? Even the federal system has a blueprint for compensation, but it's not done in every state, and so people who serve time get out. And they do not receive compensation in a state like Pennsylvania, but in other states they do. The strategy is to look at what happens in other states and to then demand legislation in this state to make the same thing possible.
Like Solomon said, often in Pennsylvania, you have to prove malicious prosecution. So you have to prove they willfully broke the law, they willfully subverted the truth determining process to put you in jail. So many people that are wrongfully convicted are not compensated. They still have the, well, up until last year, they still had the arrest on their record. So when they went out for jobs, people still saw them. I was blessed. And I don't want to say I'm blessed, but I was better than those fellas. So I was able, I have a wrongful conviction that involves malicious prosecution, involves willful misconduct, involves police coercion. So I'm currently in civil court on the federal level in a lawsuit. But as Solomon said, there's a lot of people that don't have that. And when you don't have it, you don't have lawyers that are willing to fight for you to get it, because there's no way to compensate them as well. So I think this is definitely important. Compensate all those that are released, are exonerated from prison, not only because of police misconduct, but because of prosecutorial misconduct, because a judge messed up. You took that man's life. He should be compensated. And when we offer this bill, don't be fooled. Don't be fooled by the fine print. A bill came out, I think it was last year or the year before. No, it was the year before last year. And it required those wrongfully convicted to accept $50,000 a year but waive the lawsuit. We have to pay attention to the fine print. Pay attention to the fine print, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
All right, Hassan. Thank you, brother. Thank you. What's up, neighbor?
With that, how you doing, neighbor? With that information that Hassan had just given us, so the ones that, those individuals that we have seen exonerated when they came out, would they fall under their law? Are there any particulars or in their case, meaning that they still have that wrongful conviction on them? And how did their process go? Where did their funding come from, their compensation?
They had to sue.
They had to sue.
They have to sue.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
They have to sue. And therein lies the problem. In some states, you automatically get compensated, right? But in Pennsylvania and some other states, you don't. That's wrong. That's wrong. You know, the wrongful conviction took place in the name of the state, and so the state should have to pay, right? And unfortunately, the state is us. And so we should be fighting to make sure that people aren't wrongfully convicted, so we don't have to pay for the mistakes of those who willfully did those kinds of things. What's up, Ezio?
Demands. You mentioned demands. And then after demands, Hassan said something about bills being in front of politicians. What happens when it takes sometimes years and years to get those demands in front of people, and then all of a sudden the politicians you're dealing with have just been, there's a whole new group that's like starting all over again. How do you keep the process going from where you started without always having to have to start all over again?
Yeah, I think, you know, the one thing that I always say about politics is that all politics is local. And so I believe you start on the local level where you can make change, right? Putting people in office who represent what you want, and when they don't, vote them out. Right. And if you don't like what they're doing, and this is what I tell people who break my heart by telling me that they don't vote. You know, if you don't like what they're doing, run yourself. Run for office yourself. You know, nothing's stopping anybody from doing that. You know, all you got to do, you fill out some petitions. Make sure that you fill out more than what you need, because they're going to knock some of them off when you go to turn them in. That's part of the way the game is played. But, you know, start locally. Start locally, because you build up your muscles that way, you know, by doing these little small things, you know, in your community, making sure that the trash is picked up. You know what I mean? You know, making sure that the potholes are filled. You know, making sure that, you know, the traffic light at the corner works where there's accidents all the time. You know, that kind of thing, man. I think that you start locally, and then you build yourself to the point where you can put some national movements in place. One of the things I learned through my activism is that you also need coalitions. You know, you see people sometimes, man, trying to do stuff by themselves. And That doesn't work out well. You need coalitions. You need to find people who share common interests with you, even if you don't agree with them on other stuff. You know, we fought to have to stop them from building a prison a couple of years ago in Philadelphia. They wanted to build a new prison, and it was about, you know, making sure people in the building trades had work, and we just going to build a prison, and y'all going to be in it. The prison is for you, right? And, you know, I got in touch with a guy from the Northeast who, you know, didn't look like me, wasn't from my neighborhood, didn't have the same experience, but they wanted to build a prison in his neighborhood. And so we had a common interest. I didn't want my people in the prison. He didn't want the prison in his neighborhood. We teamed up. We got this common interest. We can, you know what I mean? We go our separate ways when this is over. But for now, we have some common interests. And you build coalitions with people, man. You find out where your common interests are and work together in order to get stuff done. That's the same way politics works, Ezio. You know, you figure out where you have some common interests. You build some coalitions, and you throw yourself into that cause until you get what you need. Good evening.
How you doing?
I'm good, brother. How are you?
Good. I'm an avid listener of you on the radio program.
Thank you.
I've never called in.
Okay.
But it's truly a pleasure to see you tonight.
Pleasure to see you, too.
I am astonished in the similarities between your story and mine.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the streets of North Philadelphia. And, you know, I was a hustler. I was always hanging with the boys and all that. And I smoked weed and all kind of stuff like that. But one day, I smoked some crack. And my life changed mm-hmm. that day for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
It took me to jails and places from here in Philadelphia all the way to Baltimore and North Carolina and then back to Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
March the 20th, I'll have 27 years clean.
Praise God.
But I just want to commend you because you are going against some obstacles and people who it's hard to deal with, hard to overcome. You know, mm-hmm. these people are capable of all kinds of stuff, but you did a lot. And I got to applaud you for that.
Thank you, man.
Thank you, brother. And also, you know, I just wrote my first book.
Go ahead, plug your book, man. You better plug your book.
What's the name of the book? But the reason I mention it is because I need some guidance from you and some advice on what you can give to somebody who's just starting to write my first book. You know, when I took it to somebody and said I want to publish it, they said, well, you need $2,000 or $3,000. I ain't gonna lie, I had $2,000 or $3,000, but I wasn't gonna put $2,000 or $3,000 out hoping to get more on the book because I don't know if it's gonna sell or not, right? But I self-published it.
So you already published it, okay.
I self-published it.
Okay.
Right?
Uh-huh.
It cost me nothing. Right? But I need to learn how to promote it, to advertise it, and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
But
well, what you got to do, one thing that you have to do is you have to figure out a short sales pitch for your book, right? Mm-hmm. Something very short and something that is going to pique people's interest and make them want to read right. more. Okay. You always want them. You want to leave them wanting more, not less.
In the introduction, right?
Yeah. So you need You need to do something. Have a real short sales pitch for your book, and then you got to figure out where your audience is, who your audience is, where your audience is, mm-hmm. And then you bring the book to them. But I'm gonna have you send me an email.
Okay.
All right. Info at well, you can send it to sj@solomonjones.com. sj@solomonjones.com. Email me there.
@solomonjones.com.
Yep. And I'll send you some advice.
Okay.
Okay?
And again, man, I applaud you, man.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate that. Yeah. One more question. We'll take it from this person right here.
Good afternoon, Brother Solomon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Olani Adefumi. And indirectly, people have addressed this issue. What is or what isn't a crack baby? And what is the technique we should use to be ready for so-called crack babies?
Well, I want to thank you for that question. I'm not going to address that here because it doesn't really have anything to do with the book, but I'll talk to you privately. You know, one thing that I will say is that, and I'll give you an indirect answer. You know, drugs decimated our communities, man. And it's something that's been used, you know, over and over again throughout history. I'm so grateful for the education that I got in the Philadelphia public schools, because after the drugs and the homelessness and all of that stuff, everything that I learned was still right here. You can't take that, right? Can't take that. You know, drugs have been used in various societies, man, to really tear up those societies and leave them ripe for invasion and conquest. You know, in China, you know, they had the Boxer Rebellion over the way that heroin had been used in their country in order to subjugate the people there. In various Native American communities here in America, you know, alcohol was used in order to subjugate the people. In our community, crack was used in order to tear our families apart. And so that is generational. And so what you end up seeing is generations of people, man, who are who've been damaged from that. And I think that we have to come to terms to that, come to terms with that, come to grips with that, understand what that is, and then move forward with some solutions for that. One of the solutions is to step back and say, you know what, y'all can put that in our community all you want. We ain't going to use it. We ain't going to use it, you know, because it's tearing up our communities and our families. So thank you for that question. I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. I appreciate each and every one of you. Thank you so much. And we're going to sign some books upstairs. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.